Good evening. You're listening to the Parliament of Rooks podcast, episode 25, Six Ways to Sunday.
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguise, as no one knows, hides the face, lies the snake. And the sun in my disgrace, boiling heat, summer stench, neath the black the sky looks dead, call my name through the cream, and I'll hear you scream again, black old sun. Won't you come to wash away the rain? Black old sun, won't you come? Won't you come?
Welcome back, everyone, to the Parliament of Rooks podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Lanise.
And this is his wife, Melanie Lanise.
So as I've been alluding to, you know, for the past couple episodes, you know, we are rapidly, you know, coming up on the end of our, you know, Silver Age coverage. You know, back in episode one, we sort of, you know, laid out what we were, you know, going to be covering, you know, in this show. And, you know, looking back at, you know, the episodes we've covered, you know, we've hit basically, you know, all those marks. We've talked about before, you know, the concept of, you know, ages in DC Comics.
Mm-hmm, like gold, silver, and bronze.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, there's not really, you know, I think I've said this as well, a sort of clear demarcation, you know, as for, you know, what actually determines the end of one age, the beginning of another. You know, we looked at, you know, the transition of gold into silver, for instance, you know, and like, certainly there were things like, you know, the end of the publication of the Justice Society, you know, but then we didn't really get into what you would think of in terms of like a silver age superhero, you know, until Flash came around, you know, in Showcase. So there's that sort of, you know, interim period, you know, we talked about last time, the Atomic Age, you know, with the Captain Comet and, you know, Strange Adventures and all that. You know, and it's sort of like a blurry line, really, you know, like, what is that? You know, is that late gold? Is that early silver? Well, the same thing is sort of going to apply, you know, as we come into the end of the Silver Age. You know, what is the end of the silver, the beginning of the bronze? A lot of people like to point to, you know, the advent of, you know, increased relevancy, you know, in DC Comics. I think I've mentioned this to you from time to time, but not on this show. I told you about there was a storyline in the Green Lantern comic book called Hard Traveling Heroes, where he and Green Arrow sort of get rid of their costumes and just travel the country in a truck, you know, looking to like help people out. You know, so that, you know, historically is like, oh, that's the beginning of the Bronze Age. That sort of, you know, coincided with a big name in the industry, Jack Kirby, who, you know, throughout the 60s had been traditionally known as a, you know, a Marvel creator, came to DC. So that also, you know, is an event, you know, that people like to link to the beginning of DC's Bronze Age.
Okay.
For our purposes, though, I actually tend to set it a little bit earlier, you know, especially since we're talking in terms of, you know, magic and the supernatural. Like everything we've looked at thus far, you know, it certainly has had, you know, magic in it, but there's been a real element, I think, of, you know, a juvenile approach to it. Not necessarily that's a bad thing, but, you know, definitely the stories that we're reading have been sort of, you know, heavy on the exposition, you know, easy on the eyes as far as, you know, art, very sort of simplistic, you know, posed art, whatever. Yeah. So that really, you know, is going to begin to shift, you know, with a couple different things. In 1967, late 67, early 68, you know, I'm not sure the exact date or whatever, but DC Comics, or, you know, or National, I think, you know, as they were known at the time, was acquired by a company called Kinney, which sort of just big conglomeration. Like, I think they mostly owned, like, parking lots or something like that.
Oh.
Yeah, but they became, like, a major, you know, shareholder in DC. And around that time also, Carmine Infantino, you know, a name you've heard,
yeah.
and, you know, and we've seen some of his art, like in the Elongated Man story. I had to check myself to not say elongated. But yeah, around that time when, yeah, you know, around the time of the Kinney takeover, he was promoted to initially art director and then across the board editorial director. So for my purposes, like, that's another, you know, event that I'm like, oh, well, that's clearly the beginning of the Bronze Age. Around that time, that's when they had a real influx of, creators, both writers and artists, who would really, from that point forward, change what we thought of as the form. Writers like, Denny O'Neill, who would take over, the Batman titles and really make it a more, mature type title than what we've been seeing.
Okay.
Steve Skeets, was another one, worked on your favorite, Aquaman, actually, and some of the Teen Titans stuff. And we'll look at that, in the next, wave of our show. On the art side, some of the big names that we'll begin taking a look at are, guys like Jim Aparo, Dick Giordano, who both an artist and an editor, actually. The arrival of Dick Giordano, from an editorial standpoint, really is another thing that, I would say, signals, the Bronze Age ethic. A lot of these guys I'm talking about all work together at another company called Charlton Comics, and Dick Giordano was sort of the linchpin in getting a lot of this new talent, over. Huge name from our purposes. Matter of fact, the first thing that we are going to look at once we start covering the Bronze Age is a strip called Dead Man. And the primary artist and then later, writer for that strip is a guy named Neil Adams. So, like I say, next, wave of our show, that name is going to be huge. Similar to, some of the names we've seen for the Silver Age, Neil Adams is going to be a prime mover and shaker.
So he's the guy.
He is the guy, I think, that heralded, at least, like I say, from Magic and Supernatural, the beginning of what we will term, our Bronze Age. But before we do that, like I say, we're not quite done with the Silver Age. There's a couple more things, I'd like to look to wrap up. We have a couple little, cliffhangers still out there. I don't think, the Stanley's monster has ever gotten a name and,
right?
And we still haven't seen, the end of, House of Secrets, So, yeah, there's a few more stories I want to touch. And like I say, with the advent of all these new creators, I think, we should probably do our due diligence, with regard to the Silver Age creators, so I'm going to put it to you, what are, some names that you think that we should probably, hit before we close this chapter out?
I think it would be incomplete if we didn't hit at least one more Gardner Fox story.
Gardner Fox. Okay. Who else?
Reluctant to say it, but Bob Haney.
Bob Haney. Okay. How about on the art side? Any artists jumping out at you as, the people that we've covered?
Well, Murphy Anderson.
Murphy Anderson?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is, actually you hit some, high marks, because on tonight's show, we are going to cover a Gardner Fox, Murphy Anderson story.
Okay.
And we're going to cover a Bob Haney story. So you got all three.
Oh, yay.
Yeah, we're going to, like I say, end of House of Secrets. So I definitely want to hit the last, Prince Rahman story. So that's, what we'll delve into as far as Haney. And, don't worry, that's only a 12-pager.
Okay. Okay.
But before that, I want to take a look at the last showcase story that's going to highlight the Spectre, which I say is a collaboration, once again, Gardner Fox and Murphy Anderson. That team that had done all the sort of, Golden Age revivals, mm-hmm. In Showcase. There's actually one more Spectre story that I guess you could technically call, Silver Age, because it still occurs, in that sort of like go-go check era. And
ooh.
Yeah, but that being said, it's a confluence of the Spectre, but also that sort of, Bob Haney Earth B storytelling. Mm-hmm. It takes place in The Brave and the Bold, and we had previously seen that, Batman Eclipso story, where, like, nobody acts in character.
Right.
So I took a look at that other Spectre story, and it's a team-up of the Spectre and the Flash called Phantom Flash Cosmic Traitor. And honestly, I don't think that fits in with, the story that we are trying to tell, but more importantly, I don't think it fits in with the characterization, of these characters. Spectre, for my money, is acting, completely out of character. It's the Barry Allen Flash, not even the Golden Age Flash, and so the rationale for him even going to Earth 2, and then, what do you get? Long story short, I'll give you a brief synopsis of the story. So Barry Allen, for some unknown reason, travels to Earth 2 Central City, which, he lives on in Central City on Earth 1. So he travels to Earth 2 Central City, which is represented as the home of the Spectre, which it's not. I've never heard Spectre as, residing there. He is captured by these, bank robbers. But the reason they capture him is because they're being, hired by this organization to bring the Flash, knock him out, and turn him into a ghost.
Okay.
So the reason they're turning him into a ghost is because there is an evil World War I flying ace who was killed by the cowardice of his squadron and is now a ghost seeking revenge on them. He wants to use the Flash and a sort of brainwashed ghost to go attack these people, and the only thing that's stopping him from doing so is the Spectre. Okay. enough. Like, we're not reading this story. You know?
Thank you.
So for anybody out there that was, you know, waiting with bated breath for Phantom Flash Cosmic Trader, you know, I'm sure there might be a Spectre, you know, related podcast out there that's going to hit all the bases. We're not. You know, our last, you know, Spectre story that we're covering, at least for the Silver Age, is going to come from Showcase number 64. It's a story called The Ghost of Ace Chance, and this would have occurred in September-October of 1966. So first things first, let's go ahead and take a look at the cover for that book.
Okay.
All right. So this cover is penciled and inked by Murphy Anderson. You know, you really see the sort of, you know, Anderson, you know, hatch lines there, you know, on the shading. And the letters on this are by our old friend Ira Schnapp. And you know, we talk about saying goodbye to the Silver Age, you know, so well, here's, you know, several elements that are, you know, just prototypical Silver Age. You know, we have our purple background, we got our go-go checks. Exactly. And what we see on this little scene is, you know, the Spectre, you know, sort of enlarged to, you know, not gargantuan size, but maybe like, you know, three times the size of a normal dude. And he's sort of like standing over a prone figure of what looks to be like, you know, almost another specter, if you will, you know, sort of like pale white skin, you know, but dressed in a full length, you know, red outfit, but with cape. You know, actually, we talk about Dead Man, you know, coming up. This color scheme is very, very evocative of Dead Man. That's sort of, you know, really bright red, you know, as contrasted against the white skin. But Dead Man actually has a full, like, you know, skull mask or whatever. You know, you wouldn't see this sort of red hood thing. Okay. But the Spectre, you know, as I say, is standing over this fellow as, you know, lightning bolts are, you know, emanating from his hands. And the Spectre's saying, "Out of my body, you squatter." As indeed, you know, he's pulling this spectral figure, you know, from the body of Jim Corrigan.
Mm.
And our, you know, tagline on the bottom tells us that this is introducing the most sensational villain of all time, the Ghost of Ace Chance. And, you know, a little bit of a play on words there, obviously, you know, Ghost of a Chance,
yeah,
right? So this story, as I say, you know, it's by Gardner Fox, pencils and inks by Murphy Anderson. Colors and letters on the inside, unknown. You know, normally we'd see, you know, Gaspar Saladino or whatever on letters, but, you know, for some reason they're not sure who did it this time out. So let's go ahead and crack this open.
Hey, let me show you, too, how to make yourself astronaut tough.
Astronaut tough? Who is this? Says Ben Robbins, today's top bodybuilding authority on our, you know, inside front cover. But I've never heard of this dude. But,
nope.
Perhaps he's a bodybuilding astronaut. But more important than that, you know, is our splash page here. You know, as we see Spectre being cleaved in two. You know, there's some, like, you know, crook that has, like, just swung an anchor at the Spectre and basically split him down the middle.
Vicious.
He's saying, "I split the Spectre in two. I can't believe it." As in our foreground, you know, we see, I guess, the Spectre himself, obviously, and this must be in memory or whatever, you know, because our prime Spectre, you know, is telling us, "Ace Chance was a gambler, a cheat, a con man, and a loser. In desperation, he took the biggest gamble of his life, only to have it cost him his life. Yet, strangely enough, his very death gave him the biggest break he ever had, to be a winner when he became the Ghost of Ace Chance." Says our Spectre, making that horrible pun again. So let's turn our page as we begin aboard a gambling ship. As we see Ace Chance all set to make a killing at roulette. You know, we see a dude in a little tux there at the roulette table. "My mind's made up," thinks Ace. "This is my last fling with Lady Luck. Starting tomorrow, Ace Chance fades from the scene and embarks on a new life. Hope I'm lucky tonight. I owe Booth Cody $10,000. But 10 G's are peanuts compared to what I'm going to have after I court and marry Mona Marcy, the world's wealthiest woman." Okay, is that a sure thing, Ace? So as the pile of chips before him shrinks and shrinks, Ace dreams on, thinking, "Of course, as of this moment, Mona Marcy doesn't even know me, or my plans to be her future husband. But I'm handsome, smart, and loaded with charm. How can I miss?" It's not very good at gambling, this one, I think. So shortly past midnight, you know, we see Ace stepping onto the ship's tender, which apparently is the, you know, the ferry that brings you from the boat, I guess, to the shore. And he rides it, you know, to the dockside of Gateway City. And see, I told you, he didn't live in Central City. He lives in Gateway City.
Gateway.
Yeah. And Ace is thinking, you know, on the tender, "I lost my last cent. Too bad for Booth Cody. He doesn't get his $10,000. My bad luck was his bad luck." Yeah, I don't think so, buddy. So We see Ace, you know, disembarking, you know, his feet striking hollow echoes on the waterfront cobblestones as, you know, from the shadows we see, you know, two thugs. Here comes Chance now. Booth will get his money's worth with interest. A cry in the night, the thud of heavy blows as the two, you know, jump out of the shadows and start, you know, thudding Ace. No, no, ah, he cries. As not far away, who do we see but Captain of Detectives, Jim Corrigan, you know, checking the doors of the Marine Museum as he's thinking, I got a tip, this place is going to be robbed tonight, but everything seems, what's that? He says, you know, swinging around to the cries of help, you know, so running in that direction, you know, what's he see but two men carrying a slumped figure up into that tank of liquid gas. So before the far-off detective can interfere, though, you know, we see those two men on top of the big gas tank, and they've got it propped open, and they're dumping Chance in, saying, the natural gas they ship from Alaska is so cold, it's like liquid. Yeah, that's what he gets for trying to freeze Booth Cody out of his horse race bets. He owes him, what, 10 grand in horse race? I guess that's not too far-fetched. I don't know, I'm not a gambler.
Yeah, know? Me either.
But,
seems a little extreme, but...
Yeah. So they dump Chance in, and as they do so, what do we see but a sort of spectral figure rising, you know, and this spectral figure thinks, I am dead. I feel a tugging force pulling a ghostly shape out of my body. I sense somehow I'm being drawn away from Earth toward a mystic realm, a sort of hereafter. And the design of this figure, as I say, you know, is very sort of specter-like, but, you know, done in red, you know, and this obviously is the, you know, internal specter, I guess, you know, of Ace Chance. And as we know, you know, all ghosts speak in whispers.
Yes.
So, so you know, as Ace's ghost, you know, floats away, we see our strong-arm boys, as they're called here, you know, attempting to flee. But no good, you know, because who swings over the rail but Jim Corrigan. Hold it, he says, you know, hitting the one guy with a knee. Don't you guys know you can't get away with murder? Hold it, I said. When you make me say it twice, I get twice as tough, he says, you know, grabbing the second guy. Trouble with you punks is you can't fight unless you do it in packs, he says, you know, knocking the guy out with a crunk. Or when you got a gun in your hand, he says, you know, leaping toward the second guy who is, in fact, pulling out a gun. But he knocks this guy out with a womp, you know. And as he does so, you know, we see rising up from his body the discarnate shape of the eerie being known as the Spectre. And the Spectre rises up thinking, my astral powers tell me there's still a spark of life in the body of Ace Chance. Got to get him before it peters out. So steel walls are no barrier to the disembodied detective, as we see the Spectre, you know, plunging through the wall down to the, you know, floating body of Ace Chance. I'll enter into his frozen shape, revitalize the faint life spark, if possible. See the Spectre, you know, going inside the body of Ace, thinking,
ooh.
His spirit being is already gone. The life force in his body was too weak to hold it. As the next instant, you know, we see that spirit being, you know, on its way to a mystic realm, and mm-hmm. the ghost of Ace Chance is thinking, another force yanking me back toward my body. I'm trying to do like a whisper gangster voice. I don't know if this is working. But so as the gambler's body rises up from the tank of liquefied gas, you know, the ghost continues to think, that's my physical body, but I'm unable to return into it. There's another spirit inside it, and two spirit shapes cannot inhabit the same body. So a mental wail of terror and despair arises from the ghost of Ace Chance as it's whipped about by opposing, tugging forces of the mystic realm and its own body. I'm being wrenched apart. If I don't get inside a human body soon, I'll be dissipated forever. How does he have all this knowledge?
Yeah,
like, you know, like when you die, do you suddenly have, like, you know, knowledge of, like, you know, the etheric realms or whatever?
He does.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, continuing this newfound knowledge, you know, Ace thinks, I need a host body, quick. Ah, I can sense such a warm living body not far away. I must enter it and live on. And so, as Detective Jim Corrigan handcuffs his prisoners, you know, who do we see entering his body?
Mm.
The ghost of Ace Chance. Thinking, how odd that this man should have no inner spirit. But of course, this is the host body for the Spectre. Once I'm in it, the Spectre will be cut off from his own body. So, unwittingly, under the control of the psychic powers of the gambler's ghost, you know, we see Jim Corrigan hurrying toward his car, and what an unexpected development, you know, thinks the ghost of Ace Chance inside Jim. I figured to assume a new identity, but I never imagined it would happen this way. I'll make my pitch for Mona Marcy as Jim Corrigan. Yeah, because she's going to be way more receptive, you know, to some, like, you know, police captain and, you know, whatever. So moments later, we see the Spectre, you know, amazed to see his alter ego speeding away from the scene. The Spectre thinks, My human self leaving the premises. Alone? Has Jim forgotten about the tip he received about the museum robbery here? And these hoodlums? odd he should just leave them here. And why didn't he call an ambulance to pick up Ace Chance and rush into a hospital? Guess I'll have to finish up here. So, at a nearby precinct house, you know, we see the Spectre, you know, pulling his, you know, Jigunda size trick, you know, he's got the little criminal zone in his hand, you know, handing them over to the cops. Look, says the cop, it's the Spectre handing over a couple of bad ones. Book him for assault and battery, officers. I have to rush a man over to the hospital. I didn't know that the Spectre was so, like, chummy with the cops. So on our facing page, we see Agent Zero. This is the third time we've seen this ad, you know, little, you know, James Bond Jr., you know, in his pocket watch or whatever, turns into, you know, a machine gun or whatever. Let's turn our page as, you know, we return to the Marine Museum somewhat later. And, you know, we see the crooks, you know, that Corgan had gotten the tip about, you know, now they're inside saying, these jewels recovered from shipwrecks all across the world are worth millions. Stop talking and start taking, you know, says another guy. As, you know, we see a dude reaching for two rubies, you know, but deep in their hearts, we see two magnificent eerie lights beginning to glow. Hey, says the mobster guy, these gems are staring up at me like a pair of eyes. As indeed, you know, we see a face begin to coalesce around him, and, you know, it's the death gaze of the Spectre. Now it's a hand, he says, flying at me. Gah, he says as, you know, the Spectre clumps him out. The Spectre, says another guy, pulling out his gun. I'll pump you so full of lead, you'll be top heavy. But before, you know, the bullets even reach him, oop, he says, he turned the bullets into puffs of smoke. As with a whoosh, you know, Spectre blows those puffs of smoke right back at the guy as he says, the smoke hit me, feels like solid lead. Oh, so he, like, he vaporized it, but then, like, solidified it and knocked him into it. But, you know, as the Spectre's doing this, you know, we see the little scene from the splash page, you know, where the second gangster, you know, comes running up behind him, you know, with the anchor. I'll anchor him to the floor, you know, he thinks, you know, swinging it overhead. Startling surprises, weird wonders, terrific thrills, continued on the second page following. Before we get there, we see our little, you know, bottom one-third ad, you know, for the stars spelling danger for Superman and Batman. The story we read, you know, back in episode, what, 23, in the weird new villain, Dr. Zodiac, you know, from World's Finest. So let's turn our page to the Ghost of Ace Chance, part two, as we see, you know, the dude, in fact, yes, split the Spectre in half. The sharp flange of the old sea anchor cleaves the air. I split the Spectre in two, he says. I can't believe it. Why should you, rash mortal? I divided my own body in half an instant before your anchor struck.
Oh, so, that's crazy.
Yeah. So as the ghostly guardian rejoins his body segments, a bolt of lightning flashes from his eyes. Ah! Says the guy as the bolt of lightning hits him, like, right in the breadbasket. Then, as two police officers emerge from booking the Booth Cody hoods, it's a weird-looking phrase, booking the Booth Cody hoods.
Yeah.
There's, like, three words
it looks wrong.
Double O's. It sounds very odd. Spectre, says the cop. He's at it again. He's brought us three more. The charge is attempted robbery this time, says Spectre, you know, with a chummy smile as he hands over the two guys. Oh, look in the back. He's in the store that, like, Spectre's, like, kind of, it's called
Julie's,
right, yeah, for Julius Schwartz. Which reminds me, actually, we're talking about wrapping up the Silver Age or whatever. Mm-hmm. We've done some spotlights, you know, we did the Gil Kane, we did, you know, Bernard Bailey, I want to say, you know, Gardner Fox. We got to do it, before we wrap out, we got to do a Julius Schwartz, you know, spotlight, you know, review his career. But that will keep, because, you know, right now we need to follow the action of the Spectre, you know, as we see him fleeing the scene, sort of, you know, running through the sky, thinking, why should all this activity weaken me so? I better return to my host body, renew my spectral powers. Ah, what's that? The ground quivering, buildings starting to shake, a terribly destructive earthquake underway. My Jim Corrigan contact will have to wait. As, you know, we see the Spectre, you know, going to investigate this. Downward into the trembling earth sinks the discarnate detective, deep into the solid outer mantle and plastic inner zone beneath Gateway City. Why is there a plastic inner zone in the earth's core? Like, you know, is that, like, I guess maybe part of the city, like, for their sewage or something? It seems very, you know, like, odd in the 60s, but I don't know. So anyways, we see the Spectre, you know, sinking down into the earth. You know, he's thinking, the pressures that build deep in the planet's molten core cause the earth's crust to shift at times, resulting in vibration that cause tremors and earthquakes. By acting as a safety valve, I can relieve those pressures by letting off those energies as steam. So we see the Spectre, you know, negotiating the inner earth, you know, grabbing, you know, I guess the cracked core, thinking, now to push those rock folds back together cement them with my spectral energies so they can't slide apart again. So apparently he does this, you know, and then, you know, rises back out. But when he rises about halfway out of the ground, what's he see but a tornado in Gateway City right in its path. I used up considerable power stopping that earthquake. I hope I have enough left. So as a bullfighter, you know, executes a pass, so too does the ghostly guardian flash his cape, you know, kind of like Toro Toro, you know, at the tornado. Oh, Toro for the tornado. So, I'll lure the tornado after my cloak, thinks the specter. Let it waste its furies in the open fields, taking such deep concentration to do this. Never felt so weak before. And so then, you know, even as the revolving vortex harmlessly swirls away, what now? Trees, apparently gone wild. As indeed we see, like, you know, the entire forest sort of, you know, grasping toward the specter. They're reaching out their branches to grab me, strangle me. So the Wonder Wraith is a... That's not alliteration. Like, you know, like it's WW, but that's like different sounds.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, technically it is. Well,
like, alliteration is two sounds that sound the same way.
Oh,
yes.
And it just happens that it's usually the same letter.
The same letter, right. You know, so Gardner Fox, you know, stumbled a bit on his alliteration and calling him the Wonder Wraith, you know, who calls upon his dwindling ergs of energy to grip those crunching branches, snap and wrench them apart. So many disasters happening, says the specter, one after another. This can't be coincidence. Someone is causing them and involving me. But why? Let's turn the page and find out why and who.
Mm-hmm.
I think we know who, though. So as we turn the page, you know, we see Spectre, you know, pull the sort of, you know, like partial body, you know, enlargement trick, you know, making his hands super big and, you know, whapping these trees back into the forest. I'm thinking, there, that'll save the lumberjacks the trouble of chopping down those trees. Now, back to Jim Corrigan, if I can. So as a cool night wind blows the Spectre along, you know, we see him making a spectacular entrance, you know, at police headquarters, you know, where he sees Jim. But what's Jim doing? He's tossing down his badge. I'm turning in my shield, says Jim. For 20-odd years, I've wasted my talents as a detective. Now I'm going to think of me first. What's this? Thinks the Spectre. Has Jim flipped? Resigning from the police force? What's gotten into you? Says the Spectre, you know, confronting Corrigan. I'm tired of you too, Spectre, says Corrigan. Go haunt a house or something. I'll put a quick stop to this by entering your body and... Oh, Shades of Pluto, I can't get inside you.
Shades of Pluto.
Good, says Corrigan. Rustle up another host. Get lost. You know, so as Jim takes off down the street, you know, we see the specter thinking, some other spirit being has displaced me in his body. That's why I've been terribly weakened by my battles with the earthquake, tornado, and trees. So I can't force my way back in. To make matters worse, as I tried to enter Jim Corrigan, I sensed a strong barrier of sinister energy about his body, as if the spirit being within him had drawn on the entire evil of the world to protect itself from me. That spirit being must know, as I know, that evil deeds generate a special radiation energy of tremendous power. Oh my God, I'm like, I'm out of breath trying to, like, you know, read all this, like, Gardner Fox, you know, prose here in mm-hmm. Spectre voice. All right, take a deep breath. Weak and alone as I am, I'm unable to penetrate the evil energy barrier and come to grips with the spirit inside Jim's body. But I know where I can get help. For just as evil creates its own unique energy, so too do good deeds give off rise to a good radiation which keeps the evil energy in check. He knows that. So we see the specter, you know, heading off into the night sky, you know, apparently to investigate some good radiation. So what he does is he drops downward to a jungle clearing where he sees a Peace Corps worker doing a good turn for the natives. And he thinks, I'll wrap this good radiation about me, then draw on it later. And so then he moves on apparently to the Vietnam War Zone and a religious service apparently, you know, in Asia. And then, you know, to a hospital where he sees, you know, somebody, you know, getting their life saved. You know, and he thinks, all this shall be used to fight evil. It's a... very odd that they're using a clip
yeah.
from Vietnam as an example of, like, good energy, you know, where apparently, you know, the hadn't as yet become jaded by the evening news.
I guess not.
So anyway, you know, while the spirit sleuth has been scouring the world to gain psychic strength, apparently his alter ego, Jim Corrigan, has been conducting a whirlwind ghost control campaign to woo and win a wife. You know, as we see the sort of montage in the background, you know, apparently Jim has approached, what was her name, Mona Marcy, right? We see her, you know, buying her, you know, flowers, and he's taking her out dancing, and he's snuggling up. You know, apparently she's fallen for it. Because handsome and charming, dominated by the sinister schemes of the ghost of Ace Chance, Jim Corrigan is ready to pop the question. You know, as we see, you know, Ace inside Jim's body thinking, my fortune hunting days are over. So then, out of the night, strengthened by all the good deed radiations, you know, we see him being approached by the specter, thinking, now to see whether that evil barrier around Jim Corrigan can withstand the good radiation I've absorbed. Our narration kicks in, telling us that, once again, the age-old struggle between good and evil is about to be fought. Join the Spectre as he battles the myth and reality of evil through the ages. The story continues to its stupendous climax on the second page following.
I thought it was going to say, to its stupid climax.
Stupid climax. and speaking of stupid climaxes, no, we see below, you know, our third page ad here for Justice League of America, which this we covered this issue in episode, what, this is 25, so blah, 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 episode 22, mm-hmm. You know, the Spectre fighting the Antimatter Man.
Which was such a good one.
Yeah, that's very good. So it's odd, so it's, you know, kind of funny that we've now seen two ads, you know, in this magazine
for that we've covered.
It's almost like we have a plan. So on our facing page, you know, we have our letter page here, the reader's rendezvous. I'm actually going to come back to this at the end of the story because there's two letters, you know, I peeked ahead or whatever that I do want to take a look at. One's by Mike Friedrich, who I told you is soon going to become the writer on JLA. Mm-hmm. He's going to replace Gardner. I don't think he replaces Gardner Fox. He might be the second in line, you know, after Gardner Fox. And then also we have one here from Irene Vartanoff. But we'll cover this at the end of, you know, this story. So let's turn our page to part three, as we see our discarnate detective digging his digits deep into the frame of Jim Corrigan, his spectral fingers tightening, yanking outward and upward, bringing the ghost of Ace Chance with them. And as these psychic personalities come into conflict, the body of Detective Captain Jim Corrigan slumps unconscious, unable to withstand their awesome forces. And as we see, you know, Spectre reaching right into Jim and, you know, yanking out Ace Chance, saying, "Out of there, squatter." So beneath the struggling shades, we see the ground shivering, shimmering, changing shape. You know, it's almost taking on like a spectral quality itself, you know, mm-hmm. sort of ghost city.
All that energy.
Yeah. As, you know, we see the ghost of Ace Chance saying, "Spectre, know now that I possess the knowledge of ages. Nothing is beyond my power to accomplish. Witness what I'm causing to happen below." Also, he's, you know,
creating
ghost city. Right. So this eerie transformation ends, and Gold Alley, the mystic street of the alchemists in Prague, takes shape. As you know, Ace Chance says, "I've learned much from the evil energies of Earth. Now I shall put my nefarious wisdom to work by calling on the basilisks to destroy you." And apparently, you know, basilisks, you know, I've seen that word before, but I don't think I ever knew what they were. Apparently they are like, you know, sort of golden dragons, you know. Which,
that one's cute.
Yeah, cute or not, you know, they begin attacking the Spectre, you know, mm-hmm. sort of biting his arms and legs and stuff. So, ha ha ha, says Ghost of Ace Chance, "while these lizards from the infernal pits pulverize your psychic shape, I'll be on my way to win a wife. And then the world." This one's saying crack. Is he cracking the Spectre's ghost bones?
Perhaps he's a kraken.
That's good. So the Spectre, you know, fighting back, says, "You're not leaving yet, ghost. I need you to overcome these basilisks." You know, so he, you know, stretches his arm, you know, to like you know,
elongated man.
Ridiculous lengths, and, you know, grabs the ghost of Ace Chance, as Ace thinks, "Got to escape his clutches. Carry out my scheme."
Doesn't look like he gets far.
Apparently not, because in the mighty hand of the spirit sleuth, the ghost of Ace Chance becomes a living club with which to dispel demons. You know, Spectre grabs him by his ankles and sort of, you know, swings him around his head, you know, knocking each one of these basilisks. And he says, "I'll use some of that evil energy in you to overcome these evil beings you've aligned yourself with." "No, no, ow," says Ace, as, you know, his head, you know, clocks right into, you know, that of a basilisk, you know. So battered and bruised, the wicked wraith screams an order, you know, apparently his ghostly form, you know, battered and bruised. He says, "Get lost, you basilisks, beat it before I lose all my powers." So in the wink of an eye, the magic street of the alchemists is gone, giving way to the dark ruins of the dread chapel of Sea Care, apparently, another ghostly, you know, location that, you know, Ace has conjured up. And Ace says, "First round to you, Spectre, but see what you can do against this diabolical sect I now call upon to aid me." So the Chapel of Sea Care, tells our narration, is the site of black masses and demon worship in the past. Mm-hmm. Energies cluster about its fire-darkened walls, and even today, the members of certain secret cults still use those blasphemous runes for modern mischief.
He means black magic.
Black magic, yes. Mort Weisinger apparently has given some editorial guidance. So what we see, you know, coming out of these, you know, spectral ruins are apparently like, you know, spectral cult members. You know, we see a bunch of guys kind of dressed like Ace Chance, really, you know, but sort of like purple robes and, you know, very sort of evil implements in their hands and such. So robes flapping, these modern devotees of evil fling themselves upon the ghostly guardian, bearing weapons of their magical arts. As unholy Sistrum and ritual lunar sword, as Paracelsus' trident and the great ring of Gyges strike him, an eerie weakness surges through the specter, you know, as we see these guys hitting him apparently with these, you know, historical magic evil implements. Didn't we've seen the name Paracelsus before, haven't we? Like, I want to say that might have been like in way, way back, like in that Felix Faust story, you know, did he sort of invoke that guy?
Maybe.
Yeah. So what does it say? Paracelsus' trident. I'm going to look that up later and see, you know, if there's some sort of reference for it. So anyway, you know, Spectre is getting, you know, beset on all sides by these magical implements as he thinks, they're evil, so absolute, so overpowering, blotting out my astral senses.
Hmm.
So desperately, the spectral sleuth reaches out, breaking off the dread altar of sacrifice. You know, I need a weapon to fight evil with, he says, you know, cracking the piece of the altar. You know, but as he does so, you know, we see Ace, you know, fleeing in the background, thinking, now I'm free to proceed with my plan.
Gotta get the lady.
Yeah, right. Gotta pretend that I'm Corrigan and, you know, like, fake marry this woman. So Spectre, you know, with this piece of the altar, you know, hurls one evil artifact upon the others, releasing their nefarious power in a flare of lethal light, thinking, as sparks flare when two live wires touch, so are evil energies released when objects come in contact. Huh, I didn't know that. But apparently, you know, that happens because we see the evil altar, you know, touch these evil weapons and everything sort of shorts out, you know, with a big vablat. So on our facing page, and we got your cult favorite here, the AMT
cat.
Yeah, let's see, he's hawking the 57 T-Bird and the new 50 Ford convertible. Let's turn our page. You know, as, you know, Spectre, you know, makes short work of, you know, Ace attempting to flee. You know, Gray makes himself, you know, large. Spectre's doing a lot of, like, you know, full body, you know, enlargement. He's, like, you know, enlarging his legs and, his, you know, I guess his abdomen or whatever to reach up and grab Ace. And he says, stay your flight, you who were Ace Chance. We've not yet finished our battle. I must escape, thinks Ace. I'll conjure up another fighting force. So, struggling furiously, the ghost being calls upon the witches and warlocks of Earth, those practitioners of ancient evil who still lurk in remote corners of the globe. You know, he shouts out, by the evil that gives you power, slay this specter by fire flower. Oh, he rhymed it. So he's calling on witches, and maybe, let's see if the enchanter shows up. So in answer to that summons, you know, we see witches and warlocks alike chanting the old spell which draws the flames of evil from the air. And we see, I guess, a witch and a warlock dancing around a fire, you know, and they're saying, fire burn and fire play, evil creep and evil stray, seek out him who you shall slay, let nothing good stand in your way. Ooh, that's a four-line, you know, rhyme. That's going to be super powerful.
Probably looking at the end of Spectre here.
That's right. So as the fire flower, you know, rises skyward, blazing petals gape wide to envelop and devour the Spectre within their flaming clasp, you know, as Ace flees, saying, those fires will follow you no matter where you go, Spectre. There's no escape from them. Ha ha ha. So, high up rises the ghostly guardian. Large go his hands as, not yet, he says. I bring these cold clouds together, pour out some of the good energies I've absorbed into them. As you know, we see the Spectre, you know, grasping. Are these clouds, I guess, rising from the fire or whatever. He's filling them with good. And so, bringing them high into the sky, he says, as the cold clouds gather above the hot fire flower, they drench its evil in a rain of goodness. This is very, like, metaphoric battle. So, you know, apparently that works, you know, and then Spectre, you know, flees up into space, you know, where Ace is attempting to escape. He grabs him out the leg, saying, I have you now, but not for long, says Ace. I've not run out of tricks yet. Up, up and away we go in this solar goat, Spectre.
What's
he made? He's made like sort of like a space chariot, I guess, you know, sort of shaped like a goat, you know, whatever.
Goat chariot.
Golden, you know, spaceship or whatever. Ace says, It will carry us into the gulfs between stars, where primeval demon gods dwell, ever since they were banished from the haunts of men. Continued on the second page following. I want to see some of these primeval demon gods. So, first we see on the left-hand side another Palisades Amusement Park. This is really a tour de force of things that we've covered, you know, all our episodes. And
it's
the
a good choice.
Anti-cat and the Palisades Park and pulling out all the stops here. So, anyway, we see, you know, Spectre and Ace, you know, deep in space in their, you know, space goat ship, whatever. And, you know, as they reach, you know, the deep expanses there, you know, we see some sort of space dragon. And as Ace tells him, "Your doom is at hand, Spectre. Here comes the winged Sauroboro, elemental being once worshipped by Earth pagans." And you know what it looks like, actually? Gosh, I'm forgetting which chapter, you know, it might have been... It was definitely during the Zatanna arc that we did, you know, Zatanna's search. And I'm not sure whether it was Adam when he fought the druid or when, you know, with Green Lantern when they fought the Warlock of Ease. But at one point, do you remember they had like a clay pot that had a dragon on it and they made it come alive?
Yeah, I think that was Ease.
That was Ease. Anyway, this looks like that exact same dragon, you know, like the design.
Did he have that mustache?
Well, like, oh yeah, almost, he's got almost like a catfish type thing. You know, kind of, I can't remember the exact design of it or whatever, but I was just going to say it's sort of odd because that design was Gil Kane, you know, this is Murphy Anderson, you know, maybe they're, you know, referencing the same source material. Maybe, you know, DC had, you know, an art library or something that they're, you know, taking a look at. But anyway, very sort of, you know, space dragony form, as you know, we see the Eldritch Terror hurling itself upon the ghostly guardian, and for torturous moments, the psychomatter body battles incarnate evil. And the Spectre, you know, drawing back his fist, thinks, "Even I, with all my powers, could never defeat this horrendous creature. But with my every victory over the forces of evil, which the ghost of Ace Chance summoned up against me, I grew stronger and stronger in goodness. Now I'm able to fight Sauroboro and win." So. Until finally, you know, by extending himself beyond the galaxy, outside the borders of space and time, to the Black Ultimate, where nothing can exist, you know, Spectre tosses in Sauroboro. "There you shall stay, frozen to inertness, all life inside you at a standstill forevermore."
So. Not the end of Spectre.
No, the end of Sauroboro, perhaps. Well, let's see what how this wraps up. As, you know, apparently leaving the end of the universe, you know, Spectre, you know, turns back around and chases down Ace Chance, you know, grabbing him by the scruff of his cloak as a sob of mingled hate and despair descends from the throat of that which was Ace Chance. And Spectre says, "Now that I've drained you of the evil energies you absorbed on Earth, back you go where you belong, inside the body of Ace Chance, where you'll lose your supernatural powers and be your normal self." "What a fool I've been," thinks, you know, the ghost of Ace Chance. "I just now realized how to defeat the Spectre, but it's too late. Or is it?" How's he going to put him back in the body? Like, I thought that dude was, like, long dead. Wasn't he, like, frozen in, you know, like, liquid, you know, helium or something? But anyway, you know, toward the hospital, you know, where Ace Chance is recuperating, comes the Wonder Wraith and his prisoner. "How is Ace Chance, Doctor?" And says Spectre, you know, coming through the wall, you know, Ace Chance in tow. "All of a sudden, he made a complete recovery," says the Doctor. "It's amazing." "Not good," says the Spectre. "Then in you go, Ghost." You know, he says, lifting this, you know, above his head. If I was the Doctor, I'd be, like, freaking out.
Yeah.
"My trick worked," thinks the ghost of Ace Chance. "In a few moments, the Spectre shall be overcome. As Spectre carried me here, by the last trace of evil energy still within me, I summoned the body of Jim Corrigan here and teleported the body of Ace Chance back to Corrigan's place. To conceal the switchover," he thinks, you know, in this, like, elongated
really
second.
Long
second. So, to conceal the switchover, I created an illusion of my former body so Jim Corrigan would look like Ace Chance. Spectre cannot possibly know this, so when he puts me inside his body, I'll regain my former powers and destroy him.
Uh-oh.
But suddenly, the ghostly guardian leans forward and fastens his powerful hands upon the quote-unquote illusion created by the ghost of Ace Chance. "No, what are you doing?" says the ghost. "I'm removing the illusion you placed over the body of Jim Corrigan to trick me into putting you into it." As indeed he does, and, you know, we see Jim actually, you know, in full tux or whatever, you know, laying there in the hospital bed. "Come along, I'm putting you where you belong, in your own body," says the Spectre, you know, dragging him out of the hospital. "How did you know? How could you have known?" asks the ghost. But the answer to that is going to have to wait, you know, because we see, you know, Spectre arrive, you know, at the body of Ace Chance, and the discarnate detective thrusts the spirit being, you know, back into it. You fooled the doctor and me, but you couldn't fool the lamp on the night table. We saw Ace Chance put the lamp through the profile shadow of Jim Corrigan on the screen. Fortunately, I saw it just in time. You have all these spectral powers, and that's what you're resorting
the
to?
Lamp. The shadow.
The shape of the shadow. But, you know, apparently, you know, that's the deus ex machina necessary to end this. Because later, after Ace Chance, you know, with his now harmless spirit being, has been returned to the hospital for further treatment, you know, we see the specter, you know, chilling out, you know, in Jim's apartment, you know, in an armchair, and, you know, Jim's musing. Canceling my resignation from the police force will be easy. But what am I going to do about Mona Marcy? She's expecting me to propose to her. You got yourself into that hole, Jim. So soon you'll have to dig your own way out of it. He didn't get himself into that. He was possessed by Ace Chance. And like, and dude, just don't propose to her.
You know?
Like,
how about it?
So, all right. So let's see if there's anything else in this mag before we turn back to the letter page. We got a Caps hobby hint. Let's see. We got a direct current. What we got here? Mystery in space. No, it doesn't look like anything supernaturally. I think, you know, both the issues that month, you know, the Dr. Zodiac and the JLA with the Spectre, you know, we already saw in previous ads. So let's just turn back to the letter page there and we'll take a look and see what Mike Friedrich and Irene Vartanoff had to say. So their comments, you know, are about, I say this is the third appearance of the Spectre in mm-hmm. Showcase. You know, we'd previously seen the first one where he confronted Asmodeus, and then the second, you know, against Shaitan. And basically, you know, these two are commenting, you know, on that. Mike Friedrich writes, "The Spectre has come. So what? This is my reaction in 10 words or less. Showcase 60 created no reason for this opinion. It fulfilled the biggest and best publicity build-up in comics history in every way. The story was excellent. The art was Anderson. And it even had two reprint panels on page 3. Remember, they reproduced, you know, the more fun comics, you mm-hmm. know. So, plus, one of the most dramatic covers in a long time. But this is as far as it goes. What can be done further? Fox can improve, Anderson can improve, and covers can improve, but the Spectre can improve. He is. Nobody can beat a perfect hero, as this issue proved. No one can even come close. The big fight scene from pages 20 to 23 make for excellent art scenes, but the Grim Ghost wasn't even scratched. To sell a story, there must be a basic rule followed. A conflict between good and evil, hero and villain, with evil having a good chance of winning. Eliminating the last clause makes for some very dull stories. Therefore, the Spectre can't go on, and I hereby cast my vote for not giving him his own magazine." You know, I say, son, you know, Mike Friedrich. So we kind of made the same point, you know, like, you know, what do you do? The Spectre's so huge, he's got to fight global. But then again, you know, we've also talked, too, about how there's different takes. Like, this particular story we just read wasn't particularly cosmic. You know, this was more like that sort of, it almost reminded me of like a Golden Age story, right? It had this sort of more like, you know, film noir aspect.
Yeah.
You know, Spectre is adaptable. And, you know, for God's sakes, like I say, Mike Friedrich has taken over JLA. He better, you know, adjust his mindset if he's going to have any success, you know, being a writer. So that's his opinion. And then, you know, let's see what, you know, potentially fake Irene Vartanoff, you know, has to say. Remember I was saying that, like, you know, people didn't believe her. So she writes, you know, "Dear editor, the second Spectre story," so the Shaitan one, "was titanic. Mm-hmm. It was not only a magnificent summary of Gardner Fox's view on life, but also a statement of the battle of good versus evil throughout the history of man. A statement so moving, yet so simple, but most of all, true." That's, I think she's talking about when they were talking about, like, you know, Peter and Moses and Buddha. Remember there was that sort of, you know, montage of the good throughout, you know, history. So she goes on, "The Spectre's not a man, nor is he a god, though his powers are roughly equal to one. He is good," she writes with a capital G, "an idea, a concept, a belief. Whether you choose to portray him as an incarnate being or not, he exists as a force of infinite power. Jim Corrigan, every man, is the Spectre. Good versus evil in the eternal battle that started with creation, and perhaps will only end with the total destruction of everything. Good versus evil in a battle which takes place every day on our streets, in our hearts." I'm just, you know, Irene getting pretty deep.
Yeah.
Thus, by definition, the Spectre is not a quote-unquote superhero. To be valid to his premise, you could never make him the possessor of a magazine, a secret identity, good should not be anyone's secret, or an assistant. Kid Spectre? She asks. Absurd. Pretty funny. In fact, to be valid to his premise, he'll always be fighting the same quote-unquote villain, evil. His battle may be unending, but it's not varied, and thus, because of the great symbolism involved, can be labeled trite. You cannot restate a statement as large as good versus evil and expect it to be otherwise. put it on another level, how can you sell a character who fights demon after demon? How can an idea have adventures? And how can infinite power possibly fail to triumph over evil, or, for that matter, over petty criminals? You may disagree with me completely and decide to run Spectre in more adventures, and possibly in his own magazine. I'm sure it would be worth buying, though I sincerely doubt if it could attain the heights of this showcase story. You know, signed, Irene Vartanoff. So yeah, she makes some valid points. Yeah. Again, same idea, you know, like how do you take something writ so large and really make it engaging month after month? I'm going to give you a little bit of preview. So Showcase, you know, magazine generally, you know, for tryouts of concepts, you know, some get their own magazines like, you know, Lois Lane or Challengers of the Unknown or whatever. Some don't, you know, some just, you know, languish and you know, there's not enough. Spectre does. So in our Bronze Age, you know, coverage, you know, when we look at Dead Man, probably almost immediately following that up, we'll take a look at the first couple issues of the Spectre and, you know, and see whether, you know, Mr. Friedrich and Ms. Vartanoff's, you know, ideas, you know, have merit.
Okay.
So yeah, so that wraps up, you know, our Silver Age, you know, stories of the Spectre. Like I said, tonight we are going to take a look at, you know, one other story, just a 12-pager, and that would be the final story of Prince Rahman. You want to go ahead and take a look at that?
Yeah, let's go.
So this is from House of Secrets number 80, and it's a story called The Death of the Six-Sided Sun, and this is going to be from September-October of 1966. You know, obviously on our show, you know, we're not doing episode after episode of the same character. We're sort of like interweaving, right, you know, through publishing history. So it sort of took me by surprise that Prince Rahman, you know, the sort of latter day incarnation of Mark Merlin, was actually kind of short lived. Like we did the story, you know, where he underwent his transformation. And that was only House of Secrets number 73 from the previous summer. So basically like this character, you know, Prince Rahman, only lasted like a year.
Aww.
Like House of Secrets, you know, we've talked before about like publication schedules, how like some magazines would come out, you know, monthly, some bi-monthly. Well, in the 60s, they had sort of an interim, you know, publishing schedule for some magazines. As a matter of fact, I think JLA was one too, where they would publish it 8 times a year. So all told, you know, there was actually only 8, you know, Rahman stories running from 73 through the one we're going to take a look at tonight, you know, issue number 80. Very, very short-lived character. So this story, you know, as I think all Rahman stories are, is written by Bob Haney with pencils and inks by Bernard Bailey. Let's go ahead and take a look at the cover. Although there is no, you know, specific Rahman content here, there's actually an Eclipso-focused cover. We do have a, you know, sort of title banner, you know, similar to when we'd seen, you know, The Enchantress and Strange Adventures, you know, just as House of Secrets, you know, featuring Eclipso, hero and villain one man, and Prince Rahman, Mind Master, you know, a little headshot. And, you know, our cover is basically, I don't know, Eclipso fighting a giant version of himself, you know, two fantastic menaces on the loose, the evil Eclipso and the giant Eclipso. Also, we're talking about, you know, this title. This is actually the last issue of this title until they revive it a few years later. So for all intents and purposes, this is actually the last Eclipso appearance too, you know, of the Silver Age proper. Yeah, I know. We're sad to see this guy go. He winds up coming back in a weird comic called the Metal Men, which it's a few years away, so you know, maybe we'll take a look at that just to introduce you to one of the weirder concepts, you know, of DC. Rahman actually is not revived until probably 15 years later, I want to say. There was a magazine, similar to Brave and the Bold. I mentioned that, how that became a Batman team-up title. There was another one in the 80s called DC Comics Presents, which was same exact thing except with Superman. And in that magazine, they kind of had a neat feature as backup, you know, little, like, you know, 5 or 6 page, you know, stories or whatever called Whatever Happened To. And, you know, they would basically take, you know, characters that you hadn't seen in ages and say, oh, you know, this is, you know, he retired or, you know, this one died, so on and so forth. You know, characters like Our Man, you know, and like, you know, and that, but one of the ones they did was Prince Rahman, you know, and basically it's kind of, we'll get there someday, you know, if we ever get a DC Comics Presents. But, you know, just as a little bit of a preview, what it is Elsa, right, is on a TV talk show, basically talking about Mark Merlin and how she suspects that he was he got involved in some like government work and had to go underground, and she thinks he's still alive somewhere and like you know, like living in witness protection, you know.
We'll be reunited.
Yeah, but then it turns out that Ra-Man, you know, who Mark Merlin had transformed into, was also missing. So this story is basically about how she rediscovers Ra-Man and he confesses that, you know, Mark Merlin died and, you know, he became him and blah 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 blah. And so there's a new status quo which would never be used again.
Right,
because
yeah.
that's the very, very last, you know, Ra-Man story until a one panel thing where he dies later on. So,
oh.
So, but all that's in the future. You know, tonight we're just taking a look at his final Silver Age appearance. Like I say, the death of the six-sided son. So let's go ahead and crack that open and you know, see how his final tale plays out. You know, as we see our splash page with the Ra-Man apparently hurtling down from space, you know, crashing into, it looks like some sort of flying saucer. As indeed, there's aliens fleeing, saying, he's hurtling down at the dome. Ra-Man has turned himself into a human missile.
Burning in.
As our narration tells us that the fantastic forces of the unknown lie beyond the understanding of mere mortals. But oh, how they threaten all of us who call this world home. And here, in this weird tale, only Prince Ra-Man, the Magnificent, stands between us. Ra-Man,
the Magnificent?
Yeah, I don't know. stands between us and the terrifying evil threat that is born of the death of the six-sided son. Now that I'm thinking about it, they normally call him Mind Master.
Yeah.
Not Magnificent, but it's Haney, so who knows, from month to month.
Oh,
he
that's
just
right.
writes whatever. So we begin near the mansion on Mystery Hill, you know, the former haunt of Mark Merlin, where we see a tall figure walking and raising an anguished voice to the night sky. It's Ra-Man is apparently talking to himself, saying, Ra-Man, Ra-Man, you call yourself Mind Master and yet cannot control your own thoughts. Always your mind dwells on one thing, Ra. Yes, I long to return to my home dimension and dwell in peace with lovely Rima and wise old Cronyak under the six-sided sun from which I draw my powers. But I've pledged myself to defend this world against evil and the terrors of the unknown. It is my duty. As suddenly we see a light flashing from the mansion on Mystery Hill. A signal from the mansion, says Ra-Man. Faithful Elsa calls me. As we cut to Ra-Man and Elsa, you know, in their convertible, heading off, toward a mission, as our narration tells us. Yes, Prince Ra-Man, you are being called by your mystic destiny to the greatest challenge of your enchanted life. As Ra-Man says to Elsa, a strange being with awesome powers loose in the city, Elsa. You're sure you weren't bewitched by watching late TV? Oh, a little reference there.
Yeah.
Don't joke, Ra-Man, says Elsa. It was the mayor himself calling. He said it was a terrible emergency and only you could help. So shortly, as the reincarnated ancient Egyptian nobleman and his lovely assistant careen into the city, I read that almost for a second as his assistant careen.
Yeah, I did too.
But no, it's Elsa. And she says, those people running in terror. What? Who? Conspire such fantastic fear? As indeed we see people, run, flee, it's awful, terrifying, help! And what they're running from, and we see in our next panel, is this, you know, gargantuan, you know, four-story alien, you know, basically a creepy-looking, scaled blue figure in, like, you know, sort of military regalia. As we see the cops trying to, you know, fend it off with, you know, their guns. Ra-Man, says Elsa, you know, suddenly making the scene. That strange-looking figure, that must be the cause of it. Oh, really, you think, Elsa? Look, the police are firing at him. As instantaneously, you know, this mysterious being gestures, and great Isis, he caused those bullets to collide and be destroyed, as, you know, we see them striking in midair. Then, the police car rising, says Ra-Man, and vanishing into some warp or hole in the air. This is amazing. As, you know, we see our alien, you know, doing some sort of prestidigitation in the back. I must stop this stranger now, says Ra-Man. Halt! I, Prince Ra-Man, the Mind Master, challenge you. And I, Gorgak the Forerunner, accept your challenge, Ra-Man, says this alien who speaks English. I was told I might meet you, Ra-Man. So be it. Now, feel my power. As, you know, puts a hand out to Ra-Man and starts making him float. Good Horus, says Ra-Man. He's levitating me. So instantly, the Mind Master exerts his own fabulous will. I've made myself weigh 50 tons, says Ra-Man. Yet still I rise. Gorgak's power is tremendous, and mine, oddly, seems to be getting weak. So slowly he rises as Ra-Man directs his famed mental beam toward a nearby metal billboard sign. You know, see Ra-Man's, you know, mental beam projection coming out, hitting a billboard which oddly says, "Visit America, the most picturesque country in all the world." Like, they live in America.
Yeah, I'm not really sure where that would be.
So, as he does so, you know, Ra-Man says, "I only hope the metal on that billboard will work." As, it does. The sign shielded me from Gorgek's mental emanations, and I no longer am being levitated. Now, by reducing my weight to feather lightness, I return to Earth. Very clever, raw man, says Gorgak, but you cannot win. As the next gambit he tries is energy blasts, thinks raw man. I'll dodge them by using my temporary invisibility. How would you dodge energy blasts by invisibility? That makes no sense. Great Imhotep, raw man thinks, turning invisible. My vanishing power. Something has weakened it, too. I cannot achieve invisibility. Yes, raw man, says Gorgak. Your weakness will soon doom you. He's right, thinks raw man. My powers grow weaker by the moment. But how? Why? I'll attempt one more attack with my mental beam. It's never failed me. By the six-sided sun, he thinks, my beam falters, fails. Ha ha ha, says Gorgak. And then the very mystic spheres seem to slow their spinning as, Rahman, says Elsa, he's running, fleeing from the fight and fear. Ha ha ha, says Gorgak, as indeed Rahman runs off. But where's he running to? Let's follow the Mind Master in his amazing flight to the nearby city museum. And he enters and says, the obelisk, my only hope. Then, as easily as a man might step into another room in his own home, Rahman grabs the lantern of my sacred ancestor, Imhotep. It still works. My journey must be swift, for this world is in deadly peril. I don't know if you remember, but the lantern is what transported Mark Merlin initially to the land of Ra. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
That guy confronted him or whatever. So apparently they turned that over to the museum, and now Ra Man's, you know, getting it as, you know, his, it means to
transport.
To transport, right, to the land of Ra. So instantly, you know, Ra Man begins the immense, incredible voyage across the timeless wastelands between this world and the lost world of Ra. And I'm just going to pause just for a moment, you know, to remark on this panel. One thing about, you know, the Mark Merlin and Rahman stuff is that it always seems to me to have really, really good art. You know, we were first, you know, introduced to Mort Meskin, but then this here is Bernard Bailey, you know, who we'd seen in the Golden Age Spectre, and is also capturing a very sort of psychedelic, you know, mm-hmm. journey. You know, Rahman's passing through this netherworld, and you see sort of frames he's going through and different planets and such, you know, quite nice. But though the journey, you know, seems to consume an eternity, within a split second, you know, we see Rahman, you know, emerging into, you know, the mystic land of Ra. Yeah, through the cat statue there that, you know, first, did it first transfer him? I forget the deal. But anyway, Mark Merlin had some sort of engagement with this cat statue. And who do we see waiting for him? But Rima? Is that
Rima?
Rima,
yeah.
And Kranyak. And Rima says, Rahman, you've returned to us. By the ring of Nephros, says Kranyak, it's our royal prince and pupil. Yes, lovely Rima. Kranyak, says Mark Merlin. Oh, Rahman, I mean, my old master. I've come back, but I'm afraid my visit must be brief. A being from an unknown dimension is loose in my world, and for some reason, my powers have suddenly deserted me. I expected your return, Rahman, says Kranyak, for look, up there, that's the reason your powers are gone, as he points through a sort of, like, you know, sunroof in his castle. The great six-sided sun, says Rahman, fading, nothing but a pale replica of itself.
Uh-oh.
Yes, says Kranyak, as the six-sided sun, source of all our health, immortality, and happiness here in Ra wanes, so too do your powers, Rahman. The sun has been weakening for some time now. But why? Asks Rahman. What's causing it, Kranyak? All my science and mastery of the occult tell me that in a dimension beyond ours, some incredible attraction is draining the sun's force, pulling it from Ra into that other world. Then I must go into that dimension, says Rahman, find out what's causing this drain. No, Rahman, says Rima. Without your powers, you might be in deadly danger. Who knows what lies beyond this dimensional barrier? I have no choice, fair Rima. It is my duty to protect the world I live in. And if the six-sided sun dies, so too do all of you here in Ra. Very well spoken, my son, says Kranyak. But I can give you powers, immense powers, by concentrating the remaining energy of the sun. Make ready. Continued on the second page following. Just real quick before we go on, Rima seems to be very, like, you know, enamored of Rahman, but that wasn't her original deal, right? Like, when we first read the transformation, it was Mark Merlin that she was into.
Yeah.
And, like, this guy is just, like, you know, a body that the essence of Merlin, or maybe that's enough for her. You know, we already established that Rahman and Elsa are swingers, maybe, you know, Rima's like that. She's like, you know, I don't care as long as you got, you know, a warm body. So let's turn our page and continue this story. For now, as Rahman's old mentor calls upon all of his ancient skill, you know, we see Kranyak, you know, putting Rahman, you know, into a throne, I guess, you know, beaming, you know, his own mm-hmm. powers into him, as he says, I warn you, waste not one atom of them, for overuse of them could exhaust you, destroy you. I'll face that danger, Cognac, says Rahman. Hurry, there is so little time. Then, you know, Rahman says, I can feel it, Cognac. Vast new powers within me. Yes, Rahman, says Cognac. But remember my warning. Now, drink this potion, and then, by a simple effort of your will, you will enter the dimension which is draining our sun's power. So quickly, the cup is drunk, and within moments, you know, we see Rahman fading out. Rahman, no, says Rima. Do not leave me again, please. Farewell for now, Rima. I will return. I will return. So again, the intrepid Mind Master enters the vast wasteland between worlds, piloting himself through labyrinths of time and space by his own will. This way, says Rahman. I sense that my direction is this way. He repeats himself a lot. And so then, you know, he pops out into this new dimension. I'm here. I've arrived. But just where am I, really? That mushroom dome. Something tells me that's my objective. As, you know, in the distance we see some sort of alien dome, you know, shaped like a mushroom. So Rahman moves stealthily, you know, in this strange dimension, you know, toward that dome. As we see, you know, a group of those aliens, you know, similar to Gorgak. Oh, indeed, one of them is. Because the leader says, excellent. Gorgak the Forerunner has sent back word that using the stolen powers of the six-sided son of Ra, it's been a simple matter to terrorize those who live in the world of mortals. Now, we prepare others to follow Gorgak through the warp. A whole army to invade that mortal world. As, you know, Rahman is listening from the trees. Great Isis, preserve us, he thinks. Gorgak's powers did come from the six-sided sun. As his grew, mine waned. And if those others gain more of the sun's powers, I'll have no chance to defeat them. I must strike now. So immediately, this man from Ra charges out. Rahman, says you know, the leader of the Gorgakian race, whatever. So Gorgak did not dispose of you, but we shall. Obliterate this arrogant meddler. So the troops, you know, start throwing energy rings, you know, toward Rahman. As he thinks, energy rings encircling me. Now to see if Cognac truly did magnify my power. So the rings settle over Rahman with lightning rapidity, and he thinks, there, a force field for my body to hurl them back from whence they came. As, you know, he does this, and then we see, you know, expanding outward, and those rings hitting Rahman's foes with fantastic force. What tremendous power, says, you know, the alien. He bowled over my cohorts. Up, you fools. Attack, attack. Use the power we've stolen from the six-sided sun. So using that power, apparently they shoot out some, like, you know, heat vision beams or whatever toward Rahman. Beams from their eyes, melting the earth in a circle around me. But what harm can that do? You'll see, Rahman, says our narration, for in the very next instant. Excellent. Rahman could not know that Orlasium, or, can be made instantly into a hardening cocoon, which nothing in our world can break. He's trapped. As, you know, indeed, we see from the ground, you know, this Orlacium ore sort of wrapping around him, almost like in a bean pod shape, you know, with Rahman inside. But then, in the very next instant, he rises upward inside the cocoon. Nothing to fear. Simple levitation, says their leader. That is all. He only struggles like a captive creature. But higher and higher, we see this cocoon rising with the Mind Master trapped inside until it turns direction. Now he hurtles down to the dome. He's turned himself into a living missile. This is what we saw on the splash page.
Where it burns in.
Yeah, so with incredible velocity and impact, we see the cocoon containing the man from Ra hit the dome and, what does it say? Krawaka Kroom. Nice. He's destroyed the dome, the drain machine, and the warp, everything. He's the aliens. As this happens, you know, we see Rahman, you know, emerging from his Orasian cocoon, saying, those concentrated powers certainly are fantastic. I can even break out of this unbreakable cocoon. Obviously, my mission here is a success. Now, back to my own world. Gorgak won't wait much longer. So traversing the unknown boundaries back to Ra, the Mind Master swiftly returns to Earth and, oh, so he's making like a two-stop thing. He like passes from this dimension through Ra back to Earth and then emerges on the street, you know, where, you know, he confronts Gorgak. He says, it seems I've come back none too soon because, you know, apparently the army has been deployed or whatever, but Gorgak's making short work of tanks and stuff. He swings around. Rahman, you dare to face me again, fool? There, feel the powers of the Forerunner. And he blasts him. Yes, you're the first of your kind in this world, and also the last, Gorgak. Huh? He says, suddenly distracted as, you know, the tank crashes behind him. The very air solidifying into hurtling spears. Well, my super six-sided sun powers can harden the air also into shields. As, you know, he creates, you know, this shield as Gorgak's creating these spears and, you know, never the twain shall meet. You know, as they're deflected with a thwack, thwack, thwack. But then a sudden thought strikes the Mind Master, as you know he remembers in his mind's eye, you know, the voice of Cronjak. "I warn you, Rahman," says Cronjak, "overuse of these superpowers could exhaust you, destroy you." As you know, I guess with that warning, Rahman, you know, starts taking a step back. "He's retreating," says Gorgak. "My chance to end this battle." As he uses this opportunity to, I guess, you know, turn the air into flames around Rahman. "Now," thinks Rahman, "he ignites the air. What a rash squandering of his powers. Thank the seers, I can use this manhole for a quick defense without using my own powers." As we see, you know, Rahman duck down into a manhole. So then emerging, you know, down the street from another manhole, you know, Gorgak spots him and thinks, "Ah, so you think to take refuge behind that wrecked tank? Gorgak destroys it thus." You know, as he blasts the tank with it with a warang. But Rahman thinks, "That's it, my otherworld friend. Keep on using your powers. So now I shall finish you. What? Nothing happens. My powers." As you know, there's like nothing coming out of his hands. "Almost gone, Gorgak," says Rahman. "Spent by your overuse of them. Now it is I who have the upper hand. Prepare to meet your defeat." "No, it cannot end for Gorgak the Forerunner," he says, you know, fleeing. "The museum, he's fleeing into it," you know, as he dashes in. So quickly, you know, Rahman enters the structure where, "Great Isis, protect us," says Rahman. "Gorgak's using what's left of his powers to go to Ra and restore them." As we see, you know, Gorgak making for, you know, the obelisk that I guess acts as the gateway, you know, between this world and Ra.
And it has I hadn't noticed it before, but it has a picture of Rima and Cronjak on it.
Yeah, a little like hieroglyph. Oh, indeed. You know, because Rahman says, "The hieroglyphics on the obelisk must told him that it was the door to that world." So he like, you know, recognized them or something. So instantly, I guess, you know, Rahman follows them as he enters again into the void between dimensions. But when the Lord of Occult reaches his homeworld, "No, Rahman," says Cronjak, "no one's entered Ra since you. There's only one explanation. Gorgak never reached here. His power gave out, stranding him between worlds." "Good Horus," wow, says Rahman. "What a fate. Then my plan to make him exhaust his stolen powers worked better than I hoped." "Aye, and your mission was a success, Rahman, for our beloved sun shines again with its old power," as indeed we see our, you know, six-sided sun glowing nice and green in the sky. "I'm glad of that," says Rahman. "Now, I'm afraid I must leave again and return to the world I've sworn to protect." So not long after, you know, in the mansion on Mystery Hill, you know, we see a reunion between Rahman and Elsa. "Rahman, you're so pensive, as if your mind and heart were 1,000 miles away." "Sorry, Elsa," says Rahman, as he thinks. "In fact, my thoughts are a world away, back in Ra. When will the fates call me there again?" The end. Well, at least not until 1985 or, you know, whatever.
You're going to have to wait, Rima.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I was thinking, like, you know, like a lot of times, you know, if series are, you know, cut off, you know, in the middle of it, whatever, you don't have like an ending. But in a way, this kind of is a decent ending. You know, it's not definitive, but, you know, you at least get to see Rahman, you know, go back to Ra. You get, you know, revisitation from, you know, those two characters or whatever. And it kind of ends almost like, you know, like sometimes on TV shows, how you'll have like, you know, a season finale or whatever, you know, it just sort of ends like on an emotional note, like, you know, "What's wrong, Rahman? Oh, my mind's in Ra." You know, so you would expect if there were next season, you know, maybe that might be the
opener.
Yeah, the crux of it, you know, him trying to get back to Ra. But whatever. This is the last story of an 8-issue yeah, you know, series. So let's see what else we got on the bottom here. For the most in thrills, Go, Go, Go.
Ooh, go checks.
House of Mystery and Mystery in Space. A lot of mystery going on.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do a quick flip through the rest of the issue. Let's see. Oh, we got a Direct Currents. Let's see, anything good? Some Jerry Lewis stuff. Teen Titans. Oh, look. Specterific is the battle between two ghosts to occupy the same human body at the same time in the October Showcase number 64.
We just read that.
let's see. Metamorpho, Blackhawk. Nope, that's it. And a Cap Hobby hint. And then the next page, Giant Eclipso. So let's just shut this book right now.
Yes, absolutely.
all right. So that then, you know, like I say, is the final appearance of, you know, Prince Rahman. We go right ahead into the judgment if you like, you know, freshen your mind. What did you think of the death of the six-sided sun? You know, just this story.
Oh, okay. I guess, overall I think it was a good story, even though it was written by Bob Haney and, you know, so, you know, of course it doesn't make any sense, but I think I've, kind of developed almost like a nostalgia for it.
What do you mean?
You know, because like
you're saying, like a fondness for Haney's style.
Yeah, because like it's just it's so weird.
You know? You know what it reminds me of? Like it's a kind of a weird metaphor. But have you ever been like as a kid or whatever, like running down a hill? And, you know, but gravity sort of takes you. So you're almost at this point sort of like stumbling. And what you're doing is not so much running as you're trying to like keep your balance.
Yeah.
You're like, that's what a Bob Haney sort of strikes me. It's like he's like throws in these elements. He's like, oh my God, how do I recover from this? You know, and so it's like a continual like progression of like new weird thing. Yeah, you can. That's a very good word for it. Yeah. But yeah, I see what you're saying. You know, people do like Bob. Like I say, I don't want to across the board say, oh, he's not a good writer. He's a good writer. Very, very creative. You know, like the Brave and the Bold stuff, you know. As much as they don't adhere, you know, to, you know, specific character designs that, you know, we would accept as continuity, they've got like a wealth of ideas, you know, that you normally wouldn't like think of. So yeah,
easy. Yeah, and that's true. Because who else would think of that?
So, so this story specifically, you know, what did you find didn't necessarily make sense?
Okay, so this is something that you mentioned actually when we were reading the story, but Rima. Like Mark Merlin.
Yeah, that whole thing is just a big mess or whatever. Like, I think, like I say, there was only a handful of stories, you know, over the course of, and I think maybe they were still trying to, like, find their footing, you know, for what was and whether. It's a weird concept to begin with, honestly. I mean, we talked about when we first, you know, when he first transformed into Ra-Man. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, like, Mark Merlin was, to my mind, like a solid series. You know, we didn't read all the stories or whatever, but, you know, you liked every single one of them. And so did I, honestly. I kind of like that detective type thing. To suddenly, like, superhero him up, you know, I think kind of, like, detracted almost, you know, from the overall series. With that, matter of fact, you know, since this is the final, you know, Mark Merlin / you know, Ra-Man thing that we're going to be covering, what are your thoughts overall, you know, on the series? You know, how did you feel about that progression?
You know, I'd say overall, I look back on it with a sense of fondness.
The whole thing?
Yeah, you know, like whether it was Mark Merlin or Prince Ra-Man, you know, like Mark Merlin I liked better. Mm-hmm. But even into Prince Ra-Man, I still look back on the series as a good thing.
A good thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird, you know, like I say, part of the purpose of this podcast was to see comic books, you know, in a specific era, you know, through new eyes. And, mm-hmm. you know, and to hear you, who had never read a comic book, have a fondness for a character, which is, for all intents and purposes, pretty much forgotten. Like, you know, like, I don't think I've ever seen a Mark Merlin tale reprinted. And Ra-Man, I only knew from his death, like I say, in one panel.
Right, yeah.
You know, so the fact that, you know, these turned out to be good, you know, is a kind of a surprise and a nice one. So with that in mind, you know, like I say, we are focused on, you know, one story, you know, per judgment or whatever. So discounting the series as a whole, Death of the Six-Sided Son, you know, what's your judgment there?
You know, I think there was enough, even though the story wasn't very coherent, I think that there was enough of a callback. Like, Haney did include that, I almost called him Mark Merlin, but that Prince Ra-Man, like, you know, came through Memcata, the cat.
Yeah, yeah, right, the cat statue.
Yeah, so there was enough stuff like that. I think I'm going to, like, that's, I think, positive. So the bird lives.
You got a living bird or something? Good.
Yeah. And also, I mean, like, the artwork.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't touch on that at all, but I mean.
You liked it?
Yeah. His, what's the artist's name?
Oh, Bernard Bailey. He's the guy who had done the Golden Age Spectre. And matter of fact, I think, you know, the last Ra-Man story we did, you know, it was Bailey as well. Very, like, you know, shadowy, you know, type artwork.
Yeah, it has more of a sense of realism than I think that than other artists.
Yeah, yeah, he's a little more abstract. Like, not abstract's not the right word. He has like a very strong, I think, like shading technique. Like, I see a lot of, like, you know, like hatching and stuff like that, you know, really, you know, sort of more sketchy, I think, uh-huh. You know, whatever. And you're right, you know, for a series like this, you know, especially where I was saying that space scene where he's like sort of transporting through the different, like, you know, frames or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, it really comes out. So yeah, Bernard Bailey, you know, thumbs up, I guess.
Yeah. You know, and actually what drew my attention to it was his version of what the alien would look like.
Mm.
Because I really didn't like the appearance of the alien, but it still evoked like, almost like a sense of revulsion.
Mm, that's good, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, well, that's what an artist should be doing.
Yeah. So, all right, awesome. So, moving back then, you know, like I say, this show is sort of, you know, a wrap-up show for, you know, several series. You know, this was the final, you know, issue of Ra-Man. But then going back then, you know, we looked at the final, you know, quote-unquote, Silver Age appearance, you know, of the Spectre.
Mm-hmm.
So moving backward to the Ghost of Ace Chance, you know, what were your thoughts on that story?
So this story, it was interesting. It had, it was like a shift for Spectre. he had been dealing with like more, I guess, bigger things, mm-hmm. like, you know.
You're saying in the showcase appearances. Yeah. He had seen, like, he had battled, what, Asmodeus
and Shatan,
right? Yeah. So he was standing for the devil. Yeah, this was more like a street level thing. Although there was a, you know, a cosmic ghost, it was less otherworldly, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, you know, and that was, you know, interesting how, like, they made a situation where it was feasible for Spectre to be on this level, like, with, like, some guy who died.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's got to get back into his body, but there's, like, somebody else occupying it now.
I almost wonder, this is me speculating or whatever, but, you know, based on what we saw in the letter column there, you know, what Mike Friedrich and Irene Bartonoff there were saying, oh, you can't do anything, you know, like, you know, once you submit. I almost wonder whether this story was written almost in response to anticipated complaints like that. You know, like, I've said before how Spectre I consider to be almost like Batman, how you can, like, place him into different genres and have it work. Maybe this was a demonstration of that, you know, on the part of the writers, you know, or writer, you know, Gardner Fox or whatever. Yeah. Any other thoughts on...
Yeah, so with Gardner Fox, he's staying true to his style. Like, I think, like, what he really wants to do overall is to, like, teach people, and, you know, like, even if it's through comic books, like, he's going to say something and you're going to learn something.
Huh. That's a really good observation. Yeah, he seems to be, you know, just a person who loves knowledge. You're absolutely right. You
yeah.
know?
He was a little bit lesser on the alliteration in the story.
Yeah, and one time he actually messed it up, right? The Wonder Wraith, right? Was
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, the story was, like, it was gritty. You know, it was, like, and I could see where, like, you would really like it. Because it was kind of like a film noir.
Yeah, those are my favorite type of Spectre stories, you know, like, because it evokes to me, you know, what was the best about the Golden Age Spectre. And then I think I mentioned this a few times. In the 70s, there was a revival of him by a writer named Michael T. Fleischer. And that really is more like, you know, street level stuff. Like you say, you know, like what I really, really like about the character. So yeah, I can't wait until we get to that point, you know, and touch some of those stories. But back to Ace Chance, you know, any additional, you know, observations about, you know, that particular story? Like, you know, how did you, like the artwork or, you know, anything else?
So artwork wise, I mean, Murphy Anderson, he was kind of like on par with what he usually does. There's like, you know, no big shifts there. He's very consistent.
Yeah. Very reliable artist.
Yeah. On the negative side, I really didn't like the way women were portrayed.
Ugh, that's par for the course with these things, right? That one was what? Mona Marcy, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, oh yeah, I'm going to marry her. And he's like, no, I'll just be a different guy and marry her.
Right, and I'll still marry her. It doesn't matter, you know.
And she was like, if I'm not mistakenly remembering, she was like an heiress, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, so, oh yeah, even if she's like, you know, wealthy and powerful, you know, her primary concern is getting a husband.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that is the main concern for any woman. overall though, I would say I'm going to judge this one favorably.
Seriously? Oh, you got two, like two live birds. In one. This is like, cause I just think of the last few episodes or whatever, you could sort of been, maybe it's like you're getting nostalgic as the Silver Age is, you know, winding to a close.
Could be.
Yeah. So, to that effect, you know, like you said at the beginning, I was asking you to, you know, project out, you know, what you would imagine I would talk about if we were talking about the Silver Age. You said Gardner Fox, Murphy Anderson,
Bob Haney,
yeah. So, okay, so those, you know, we covered in this episode. The next couple episodes, we're still winding down the Silver Age. If I threw out the names to you, Arnold Drake and Bob Oxner, you know, what series have we done here on our show, you know, that those two names, you know, might be associated with?
Stanley and his monster?
Stanley and his monster, exactly. So yeah, on our next episode, like I say, you know, we're looking at sort of, you know, final things. This is not the end of the Stanley and his monster series. You know, they'll continue in Fox and Crow. And then, you know, at a certain point, you know, I think they'll actually transition that title to their own. But for our purposes, you know, the sort of narrative thread that we've been looking at, you know, is, you know, hey, kids, send us in your name for the monster. You know, our Silver Age wrap-up, you know, will then be, you know, Massachusetts will actually get his final name.
A real name.
A real name. So, yeah, so that is going to be our next episode. For this episode, you know, is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Nope, that's a wrap for me.
That's a wrap. Okay, with that in mind, then, let's just, you know, take a moment and, you know, give our contact info. As always, you know, you can find us at our website, that being tporpodcast.com. And, you know, that's where we store all of our episodes. And then, you know, if you want to comment on any of those or, you know, like send us suggestions or, you know, complaints, ask us about some of the music we use, you know, whatever questions you might have, feel free to send those to tporpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to join our Facebook group, you know, that's where we host all the supporting images for our show. That is facebook.com/TPOR podcast. And then, you know, probably our most popular venue these days would be Twitter. And we are at TPOR podcast there. You can subscribe to our show, you know, on any of a number of venues, you know, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Podcastpedia, you know, if you just search Google for TPOR podcast, you know, I'm sure you can find the, you know, the podcatcher of your choice. And, you know, with that in mind, that's all I've got. So thank you as always for joining us. We hope you had a good time and we hope to see you here next time on the Parliament of Rooks podcast.
Thanks, everybody.
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguises, no one knows, has the face. Come wash away.